falling in line behind Ahmed. Antonio backed the accordion gate away from the plane door before jumping the 2-foot gap to get back on the plane. He gave his ever-present cocky smile after landing the jump. "Never in doubt," he said. "Next time, wait for one of us to be by the door to catch you," John told the young man. "We can't afford to lose you."
"Next time?" Solange asked him.
"Yeah. Next time he's jumping from a ramp onto a 777 bound for Lihue," John replied sarcastically. "You know what I mean." Antonio shut the door and locked it into place.
"The trick is going to be getting off this thing on the other end," he said.
"Emergency slide," John told him. "You get to push the cows."
"Emergency slide," Antonio said back, realization in his voice. "Yeah, that makes sense."
"Stick with us, Tony. We've got your back," John joked as Antonio walked into the cockpit. There were 4 seats in the cockpit. Peter motioned Antonio to the other front seat. Ahmed sat behind Antonio. Ahmed had not trained with Peter, but his previous experience as an investment banker, a job with extreme hours and pressure, made him a nice third person in the cockpit.
"I guess it's time to leave," Peter said to them.
He pressed the button to start the plane. Cheers erupted from the cabin.
"Next stop, Lihue, Kauai."
He backed the plane away from the terminal and started towards the runway. Peter picked up the intercom.
"We are currently first in line for takeoff. Please secure any farm animals that may be loose among the cabin and get a good hold of your dog. We should be off the ground shortly."
He set the intercom down and drove to the end of the runway, turning the plane at the top of the strip and directing it into takeoff position. Peter undid his buckle and got out of his seat.
"Come on,"
he said to Ahmed and Antonio as he walked to the first-class cabin.
"This is it," Peter said loudly, addressing the group with purpose in his voice. "I'm not saying we can't change our minds and land back here, because we can, but this is it. Once we hit water, or maybe even when we drop our first set of flyers, we're committed."
He clapped his hands together.
"Is this our final unanimous decision?"
The plane was quiet. Emily, sitting in the second row aisle with Jay in the window seat on one side and Brian across the aisle on the other, was the only one to reply.
"Let's go to Hawaii and restart our lives, Peter."
The old man nodded with finality and said,
"Okay, let's do it.
Come on, guys." He directed Antonio and Ahmed back into the cockpit. They sat down in their seats, and Peter revved the engines. Without fanfare or another announcement, Peter pushed the controls forward, and the plane sped down the runway. Peter adjusted the flaps. The front wheels came off the ground, the back wheels lifted, and they cleared the trees at the end of the runway by several hundred feet. They were in flight and headed west.
Dan leaned towards Brian. "Pretty exciting, huh?"
"Flying is boring. You have to sit in your seat the whole time, and my mom told me this flight is for like 2 days.
Brian crossed his arms, lamenting the next 12 to 14 hours.
"We'll figure out how to make it fun. Don't worry," Dan assured him. "We hooked the gaming gear up to the big television in business class, and we can run movies back there. You kids can have your run of that section."
"Can I go now?"
Brian's arms uncrossed.
"Let's give it a few minutes," Todd told him. "You have a long time to have fun."
"I know we're free to do what we want," Peter crackled over the intercom. "But stay buckled for a few minutes while I get up to the correct altitude. It can be bumpy at these lower levels. Dan, if you want to load the flyers while that room isn't cold, you can get up, but everyone else should stay seated for a few minutes."
The intercom clicked off. Peter put the microphone down.
"This is going to be an adventure, fellas. I don't have a weather report. For all we know, we could be running into a huge tropical storm in Hawaii, or a spring storm in any of our cities. We'll play it by ear."
Peter settled into his chair. He had flown for over 50 years and never lost the thrill and love of being in the air. It was in his blood. He knew this was close to his last flight, and he soaked in every minute.
"Do you need me to stay up here?"
Antonio enjoyed the takeoff, but was more interested in seeing a movie or gaming in the back of the plane.
"No," Peter told him. "If Ahmed will stay, I should be good. I'll call you if I need a break or the restroom." Antonio jumped up and went in the back.
If you can get another person to sit up here, you can take breaks, Peter told Ahmed. I just want someone with me to make sure I don't fall asleep.
The computer is flying us, right? Ahmed scanned the controls.
Yep, but I don't want to risk not having two people up here.
Well then, what do you want to talk about? Ahmed asked, his aviator sunglasses reflecting the blue sky and clouds.
Warm water, Peter replied. The warm ocean water I'm going to dive into when we get to Hawaii. Sandy beaches, empty from one end to the other, and beautiful blue, warm water. Ahmed and Peter discussed the joys of tropical living and their anticipation for sweating under a hot sun for the first time in months. Peter missed fresh fruit more than any other food. He could take or leave steak, but bananas? They were his favorite.
Their conversation lasted into Chicago's airspace. Peter kept the cabin door open during the flight. He turned and yelled for Dan as the plane approached Chicago.
Yes, Dan replied, poking his head through the door a second later. Are we locked and loaded with the flyers? Peter asked.
We've been good since we left.
Peter picked up the intercom. If everyone could sit down, I'm going to give our Operation Paper Drop a try in the Chicagoland area. It might get a little bumpy while I'm descending, so buckle your belts for a few minutes.
He looked at Ahmed. Where should we go? We only get one shot at this.
I would guess people would stay by the lake for food, but I have no idea. We can't drop the paper by the lake. That would be a waste.
Ahmed laughed.
We should have discussed this earlier. Maybe it wasn't a game-time decision.
Todd snuck up to the cockpit and strapped into one of the empty seats. We lived in Chicago for 5 years. Let's go up to Evanston by Northwestern. It's near the lake. Some of the paper might blow into the lake, but it's a chance we have to take, right? That's why Avery laminated a few. I know you're probably thinking people might live right on Lake Michigan to fish, but I doubt it. Not in the winter. They would go to the suburbs. There are plenty of small ponds to fish. There are deer and game to hunt. West and north of the city is the place to drop.
Peter descended at a comfortable pace. There was a little turbulence, but no big drops or jolts. The enormous plane absorbed most of the turbulence bumps.
I'll fly straight up the city, drop the leaflets coming from the south. When I see the football stadium, I'll bank west, open the gear, and we'll give it a try.
All we can do.
Todd was curious to see if the flyer program worked.
I'm going to put it on the screen for everyone to see. Peter smiled. His teeth were white under his 3-day salt-and-pepper stubble and dark sunglasses. He pointed to a button that read, Rear Camera.
This plane has a camera on the belly. You can watch the landing gear go down. A fun gimmick to keep the passengers occupied.
Nice. Ahmed duplicated the old man's grin while nodding in approval.
Chicago loomed in their front window. Peter was down to 5,000 feet, and the ride was choppy. He buzzed over the Sears Tower heading north. Todd watched as they passed over a noticeably brown Wrigley Field. The normally green ivy appeared dead.
I miss baseball. I didn't go to many games, but it was a big part of my life. I never saw the Cubs win the World Series.
Damn.
Like the Rapture had anything to do with that, Ahmed replied sarcastically.
That's the place you're talking about, right? Peter pointed towards the football stadium at Northwestern.
Yes, go up a little bit more. Turn and drop.
Todd's face was glued to the window to see the flyers. Peter waited a few seconds, turned the plane west in a wide bank, and announced to the cabin.
Well, folks, pardon the interruption, but if you would please focus your attention on the viewing screens, you'll see our first attempt to contact other survivors.
Peter flicked the camera button to on and dropped the landing gear. The passengers watched their television screens as papers flew out of the bottom of the plane. The kids screamed.
It sounds like it worked, at least from our end, Peter said to Ahmed and Todd.
He kept the landing gear down for a few minutes before raising the wheels. Peter set the altitude to 36,000 feet and sat back as the plane ascended. When the plane was back to appropriate altitude, he noticed the fuel gauge needle was down a notch.
We have a problem,
Peter reported to Todd. We can only drop leaflets one more time, maybe twice.
What's wrong? Ahmed asked from the co-pilot seat.
It's eating up too much fuel. We burn more at the lower altitudes, and climbing back up to 36,000 is almost like taking off again. If we fly to Texas, drop flyers three times, maybe hit St. Louis going there, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco on the way up the coast, we'll crash in the Pacific before we get to Hawaii.
Holy shit, Todd said.
Don't panic, we're fine. But we can't drop flyers from here to Honolulu. Pick two more cities, and we go from there. I suggest L.A. We drop as many as we can, then we fly to our new home.
I'll discuss it with everyone. Damn.
Well, it was a nice if we can. I'll let Antonio know he might not get a bump in his female population. Todd unbuckled and went into the back.
You need anything? Ahmed asked. I'm going to use the restroom, grab a drink and some crackers.
I'd love a water, thank you. Peter sat comfortably in his seat. The plane was on autopilot towards Dallas. Peter took a guess and changed the destination to San Francisco. The plane altered course, steering ever so slightly towards the west.
We'll hit San Francisco and L.A. Anyone who stayed in Texas in July probably died from dehydration or heatstroke, he mumbled to himself. Or they made the smart move towards the coast and are in Mexico or Los Angeles.
Todd relayed the fuel concern to the group. Doing it two more times would not be a risk, but that's it. We can fly low through San Francisco, L.A., then it's off to paradise.
You really think people are in San Francisco? Avery asked.
It's a big area. Oakland is there, San Francisco, Sacramento. They could fish for food. The climate is nice.
Yes, probably a better bet than L.A.
L.A. is hot. People in California would migrate north to escape the desert, John answered.
I'll report to the captain.
Todd walked towards Peter, meeting Ahmed in the steward's cabin. We vote for San Fran and L.A.
I thought as much, Peter replied. I set the location to San Fran. We can drop the paper and fly down the coast to L.A. at a lower altitude before climbing back up and out to Hawaii.
Peter looked down at the computer. We have 3 hours before the drop. Can you let Dan know he can reload whenever?
Peter remembered their confusion about where to drop in Chicago. And ask if anyone has a suggestion on where to drop in San Francisco. I've been a few times, but only as a tourist. Am I dropping on Nob Hill and calling it a day? Peter asked.
I'll check. And if you need relief, I can send Tony up here. He's playing games and watching videos with the other kids.
I'll stretch my legs and walk back with you. Ahmed, you okay for a second?
To just sit here, right?
I don't do anything. Ahmed had mild concern in his voice.
Just sit back. Enjoy the view of nothing and eat your crackers, Peter told him. I'll come back with some Milano cookies. He gave Ahmed a pat on the shoulder. Peter used the facilities and came back to the cabin.
Has anyone spent any time in San Francisco?
I went to Stanford, Dan told him, raising his hand.
It's a complicated area. San Francisco is big, Oakland is big, Sacramento is big, and there are sizable towns up and down the coast. All of the areas are suitable for people.
He thought for a minute. Let's descend over Oakland, drop flyers on San Francisco, keep low, and I'll throw leaflets all down the coast. We have more than enough papers. I'll save 1,000 for Honolulu.
I don't want to raise and lower the gear. Can you not get sucked out the trapdoor hole if I leave the gear down?
Peter was wary of playing up and down with the landing gear.
I hope, Dan laughed. L.A. is a desert. No one could stay there. They'd die. Any survivors would migrate to Malibu for food, water, and vegetation.
Dan shook his head. California and L.A. had so many people. I bet there are 50 survivors down there.
He paused.
Let's fly to San Diego. Keep the landing gear down to Malibu. The odds are high a group of people are down there.
I can do that, Peter told him. We'll make it work. We have plenty of fuel with our revised plan.
How about this? Dan continued.
I'll work with the door open in SoCal. If I don't get sucked out and can drop flyers to the ground effectively, I'll pepper Northern California the same way. As a favor to me, let's add Seattle before we back west to Hawaii. A smile crept across Peter's face. That is a great plan. I'll call you when we're close. You have 2.5 hours until we hit San Diego. Peter walked back to the cockpit and sat in his chair. He checked the instrument panel, adjusted their heading from San Francisco to San Diego, and settled back in his seat to talk to Ahmed. Dan stood to load flyers into the landing gear. He watched the group from the door of the steward's pantry. Despite the total collapse of society, people still followed established rules with regards to plane travel. Seat belts were fastened, and his friends remained in their seats. "What's the story?" Bernie asked. She was on a break from the kids, who did not need the chaperoning she anticipated. The children watched movies and played games happily and without incident. "We're going to fly over California, drop leaflets from San Diego to Seattle. We have about 2.5 hours," Dan explained. "I'm going to load flyers. I want a movie rolling when I get back." 55. Dan and Paul wore gloves, ear protection, and coats as they stuffed rescue letters through the jet's floor open to clouds. Their ears stung from the noise despite their protection. They let go of the bundles of notes above the opening and watched the papers get sucked to the ground. Peter assumed the cold would be unbearable, but the noise trumped any discomfort the sub-zero temperatures posed. Paul grabbed the trapdoor handle and shut the hole. "That's enough. I can't take any more. I want to hear when I get old," he screamed to his friend. They had thick rope wrapped around their waists, safety lines preventing them from getting closer than a foot to the opening. The lines were not to help them if they fell out of the hole. The lines prevented them from getting anywhere near the hole. The noise was deafening until the landing gear was raised and the outer doors thumped shut. Dan sat with his legs stretched out ahead of him. He panted. It was not hard work, but it was exhausting to stare into a 5,000-foot abyss, throw papers, and make sure you do not go with them. He used his hands to keep himself up, his palms on the ground just behind him. "You think there was anyone down there?" Dan asked with a yell. "I don't know. You stayed in Boston, and that place was freezing. I bet survivors stayed. Where would they go?" Paul stood and reached his hand out to help Dan off the ground. "We're doing what we can. What we know is right." Paul grunted as he helped the large man to his feet. "Thanks for the help." Dan pulled off his gloves. "You're right. All we can do is what we can." The plane ascended slightly. Paul opened the trap door and threw 2,000 notes into the wheel well for the last West Coast drop in Seattle. "You should go up front to see the Space Needle one more time," Paul told him. "It shouldn't be too long. Maybe another 4 hours before Hawaii." The stack was down to less than 1,000. Dan and Paul peppered California with close to 80,000 rescue pages. "I hope Peter takes a break. He's been sitting up there all day." Paul unzipped his coat and placed it on a pile of luggage. "He won't. You can tell this is what he does. He flies planes. If you were doing the thing you loved for the very last time, wouldn't you soak it in?" "I would." Dan placed his jacket with Paul's. Dan enjoyed the Seattle skyline one last time. It was raining. Peter opened the landing gear over the Space Needle before banking west towards Hawaii. He hoped the rain would not destroy all of the flyers, though he knew 50 of them were laminated. Peter made an announcement as Dan and Paul walked towards the cargo hold to dump papers in the wheel well for the drop over Honolulu. "Ladies and gentlemen, we have begun our final ascent towards Lihue International Airport. Kick back. According to the navigation computer, we'll be landing in approximately 3 hours and 42 minutes. The next land you see will be the beautiful island of Oahu." Dan and Paul shook hands after the final loading of flyers into the landing gear well. "Let's get back to our seats before they put a rom-com on the screen." Paul looked at the animals. He nodded to Kelly and Karen, playing gin on the ground next to the cows. "To be honest, I didn't go to many movies. I'll watch pretty much anything. Dan did not rush like Paul asked. You have to back me up on this one. I can't watch another romantic movie. I just can't, Paul pleaded.
Okay, I'm just saying. I haven't seen it, so it wouldn't be the worst pick.
Dan raised his hands in mock surrender.
Just work with me, okay?
Paul parted the curtain into first class. When Harry Met Sally was on the screen, he dropped his head.
Awesome. I haven't seen this before, Dan said, sitting next to Todd. Paul, can you look for some popcorn like you said you would?
Thanks.
Popcorn sounds great. Thanks, Paul, Emily told her brother-in-law. Maybe pass around some drinks, too?
Paul's mouth opened slightly in disbelief. He risked his life to throw flyers out of the plane, and now he was relegated to steward duties. Dan did not make eye contact with him.
I'll take a Sprite, Jamie called out, eyes glued to the screen.
Coke, Todd raised his hand.
Orders continued. Paul was in a no-win situation. He went to the pantry for popcorn and soda. 56.
Peter's voice interrupted the movie.
About an hour. Stretch your legs if you need to.
The adults were antsy and nervous. The kids, entering their 12th hour of media, were ready to get off the plane. Even the animals in the back grew increasingly restless. Kelly did not want to use additional tranquilizers or sedatives on the animals. She was sure she could manage them for another hour, probably close to 3 hours at their current doses. Her biggest concern was the bull. If he woke, he would get rowdy with the cows and surrounding animals. She assured those who came to see the animals that the bull would be asleep for several more hours. Secretly, Kelly was not as confident. She had tranquilized horses, but never a bull. In theory, the weight-to-sedative ratio should be the same. But theory and practice? Kelly prayed the big animal with horns and a temper would stay asleep. Greg and Rebecca sat quietly for most of the flight. They occupied seats in the last row of first class next to a window. Matt and Avery sat in front of them and turned around often to pester the couple. Greg and Rebecca played cards, a travel version of Scrabble, or talked quietly. Rebecca was the only one who knew Greg was secretly afraid to fly. Towards the middle of the flight, Matt goaded the teens into playing Monopoly. The game lasted over 3 hours, and most of the plane watched parts of the match. The long flight reminded Greg of the days he spent stuck in the Webster cottage, snowed in or weatherbound by negative temperatures. If he had not been afraid of flying, the 12 hours would have been a breeze. Towards the end of the flight, even the stoic Greg felt the excitement of landing.
I can't believe we're going to make it.
He gripped Rebecca's hand tightly. Matt turned around and put his palm in the air for a high five. Greg released Rebecca's hand and slapped his brother's. Avery knelt backwards in her chair to face them.
"This is so exciting!" she practically yelled.
Greg wandered into first class from the video game marathon.
"Are we almost there?" he asked.
His eyes were wide open and bloodshot, as if he had watched television for a week.
"Better grab a seat, Craig. We're about to land."
Matt pointed to the aisle seat next to Rebecca.
We know what we're going to do when we land. Are there going to be cars? Do we know where we're going to stay the first night? I'm hungry. Can someone get me a drink?
Rebecca stared at the boy. He was young, but should not have whined like a 4-year-old.
You can go grab some chips or crackers up there.
Rebecca pointed towards the steward's area. She had never been as helpless as Craig appeared to be. Craig asked if others would like something. And despite the no replies, he brought back 2 boxes of goldfish, an assortment of chips, and bottles of water.
"So what are we going to do when we land?" he asked again.
Matt put a chip in his mouth.
"Well, we've done some advanced planning. Don't get too worried. Tony was smart enough to load 5 new car batteries into the hold. We'll swap out dead batteries and get cars or vans working. We've studied guidebooks and found several places for tonight. It's going to be afternoon when we arrive, but we'll be exhausted. We just want beds for the night.
Food?
Eat what you can right now.
I believe we're hoping for fruit and other things to materialize tomorrow. I doubt we'll do dinner tonight.
Peter's voice came over the speaker again. If you look out your window, you'll be able to see the islands of Hawaii. We'll fly low over Honolulu. We should be on the ground in less than 20 minutes. I have received clearance from the tower. We are number one to land. Some of the adults chuckled. Craig did not understand.
But there aren't any other planes, he said to Matt.
That's the joke, Matt told him. Anyway, yes, we are ready for when we land. I'm not sure it's going to be a bang-bang operation, but we know what we're doing. He looked at Avery. You have any idea how excited I am to be warm? I haven't been warm in like 6 months. You've been cold? I was in New York. You were in South Carolina. Avery rolled her eyes at him. It's going to be incredible. I might run into the ocean with all my clothes on. She had a grin on her face, as did everyone in the first-class section. The excitement was palpable. Peter looked out the window. An hour ago, he was exhausted, falling asleep in his chair. Now he was full of energy, ready to land the bird. "You see anyone?" he asked Ahmed. "No smoke, no cars moving, nothing." Ahmed slept for most of the trip from Los Angeles to Seattle to be rested and ready to help while they were over the ocean. He looked out the window at the large city. Honolulu was below them as Peter had brought the plane in low. He dropped the landing gear, and the last flyers fell from the plane. Peter brought the plane higher to allow him to see the Lihue runway from an appropriate distance. He pointed to the island. "There she is." Peter grabbed Ahmed's upper arm and began shaking it back and forth. "God damn, there she is. We made it. I had my doubts, but we goddamn made it." Ahmed turned. "Wait, what? You had your doubts? What do you mean?" "Nothing. Never mind. I'll tell you over a tall glass of pineapple juice. Just get ready to pull the cord on that emergency door and feel the heat of the sun." Peter studied the maps of Kauai and knew the location of the airport, as well as the direction of the runway. It did not matter which end of the runway he started his landing. Those rules were gone. Peter knew Lihue was equipped to handle 777 landings, but he was not sure how much wiggle room he had to stop the plane. There was a difference between "you can land the plane" and "it's easy to land the plane." The runway stretched ahead of them. It was clear of planes and apparent obstacles. "I'm glad we timed this correctly. Arriving at night would have been a problem." He chuckled. Ahmed was not amused. "Exactly how many concerns did you have that you did not voice?" Peter touched down as close to the beginning of the runway as possible. When all of the wheels were on solid ground, he slowed the plane. He did not stop at the end of the runway. He turned the jumbo jet towards the airport. Screams of joy erupted from the cabin. Ahmed patted Peter's shoulder. "Great landing, Captain. Great flying." "Thank you, Ahmed. It was my pleasure." He steered the plane next to a stair truck, parking a few feet from a gate ramp. The strong and stoic pilot powered down the engines, put his face in his hands, and sobbed. 57. Antonio opened the door of the plane. Hot air blew inside and hit him in the face. "Damn, it's hot here. I mean, it's like 80 or 85. He pulled an emergency handle, inflating a giant yellow slide from the doorway and creating a path to the ground. He cradled the car battery tightly on his chest, both of his arms curled around it like he was holding a baby. He sat down on the side of the plane, extended his feet out, and inched his behind onto the slide. When his butt was off the end, he slowly made his way down. He used his feet to moderate his speed. He set the battery on the ground and turned around. John and Hank looked down at him. "It's all good," Antonio yelled to them. "Let me get the truck started and I'll bring the stairs over." John jumped out and slid down to the tarmac. "You think you get all the fun?" They made their way over to the stair truck. "What do you want to do? Get the stairs over and then see if we can get the ramp?"
"Yeah, let me get the truck going. We can get everyone off and I'll move the ramp over so Kelly can walk the animals into the terminal."
The keys were in the stair truck ignition. Antonio expected them to be. He turned the key and got a respectable light-up of the dash, but the truck did not turn over.
He popped the hood and installed the new battery. The truck turned over immediately. With John's direction, Antonio guided the stairs flush against the rear door of the plane. John ran up the stairs and knocked on the door. It popped open with Emily's smiling face on the other side. "Welcome to paradise, ma'am. Please watch your step." Emily nodded to her brother-in-law. She held the second battery and wore a set of jumper cables around her neck like a scarf. She walked down the stairs towards Antonio. "Tony!" she yelled over the wind on the tarmac. "Let's find a vehicle!" Antonio got out of the truck and met her for the walk. "Are we looking for a big hotel van? Maybe two vans?" he asked her. "We're looking for something that will start. That's the first priority, Tony. A vehicle we can get started after it's been sitting in the sun and salt air." Antonio took the battery from her. It was the chivalrous thing to do. Lihue was a small airport, closer in size to Lebanon than Manchester or Boston. Emily found it was too hot to exert herself beyond walking quickly. "It's warm, huh? I'm not used to this much heat." Beads of sweat formed on her forehead. They made their way to a large parking area. There were rental cars, rental vans, hotel vans, and a local shuttle van. Emily pointed to the shuttle. It was large enough to bring the entire group. "Can we start one car and jump a few more off of that battery? I know we'll probably take two or three groups from here." "It's all about finding the keys," he told her. They walked to the shuttle. It was parked in the fire lane, left in what appeared to be a hurry. Antonio pried the bus doors open and searched for keys. He came up empty. He was drenched in sweat. "Let's go with our first plan. Hit the rental counter where we know there are car keys. It's too hot to mess around like this." "I agree." Emily was in shorts and a t-shirt and was still warm. The sudden climate change was too much for her body to handle. She followed Antonio towards the terminal, leaving the jumper cables next to the car battery he put down on the sidewalk. They approached the rental car area. Antonio walked behind the counter and opened a cabinet holding dozens of car keys. "We want SUVs, right?"
"Yeah, for now,"
she answered, wiping her forehead again. Antonio pawed through a cabinet of keys on the wall, pulling off chains with SUV models scribbled on the white tabs. Tahoe, Escalade, Explorer, Expedition. He handed the keys to Emily.
"That's seven. Good enough for now."
She flicked her head in a let's go back out motion. Emily looked around the airport. It was empty. There were no bodies, no bags, nothing. Antonio put one set of keys in his pocket, a Mustang convertible. He was going to drive the car until it stopped working. Emily was already outside, and he hurried to catch up with her. Dan and Ahmed stood on the curb waiting for them. "How incredible is this?" Dan asked. "No humidity. 80 degrees. Unbelievable."
"I thought there might be bodies or something, but this place is empty. Deserted.
Now that I think of it, I didn't see any planes." Antonio looked at her.
"What's the first vehicle?"
She held up a set of keys and clicked the panic button. Lights on an SUV in the second row flashed weakly. The horn gave a half-hearted blare before stopping.
"I'd say that battery's dead."
Antonio picked up their new battery and walked to the vehicle. Emily used the key to unlock the door. She popped the hood and waited for the boy to do his magic. "Try it," he told her after a minute under the hood. Emily turned the key, and the SUV came to life.
"Yes," she said to herself.
The fuel tank was full, as they hoped all of the rental cars would be. She cranked the air conditioning and waited to see what Antonio wanted to do.
"Keys?" he asked her. "I want to see if we have the ones for the trucks on either side of this one. You know, make it easy to jump."
"I'll go back inside and get them." Dan walked behind the two trucks and noted the license plates, makes, and models. "I'll be right back." Antonio took a spot in the air-conditioned car until he saw the lights flicker in the SUV to his left. He got out and opened its door, popped the hood, and jump-started the car. With a system developed, they soon had 7 SUVs running. Antonio pulled the new battery from the first SUV, inserted the old battery, and jumped it from one of the running vehicles. He walked the new battery into the terminal to use on the telescoping ramp. From the windows in the terminal, he saw everyone was off the plane. Supplies, food, and water brought for their initial days were rolled down the yellow inflatable slide. Antonio watched three SUVs drive onto the tarmac. The little kids jumped in the air with excitement, and the adults clapped. Antonio looked down at his watch, already switched it to local time. It was 5:30. He was exhausted, but like the rest, he had work to do. He had to get the gate door open, the ramp motor working, and the ramp over to the plane for Kelly to walk the animals off the jet. They also had to find a place to sleep tonight. Despite the work ahead of him, Antonio was excited and happy. He did not believe they would make it to the island. He was prepared to die in the air, or have the plane land in a city somewhere other than Lihue. He never believed he would be standing on a tropical island at the end of their day. Antonio was a pessimist, often proved wrong, but correct enough times to believe he was unlucky. His pessimism led him to just join a gang and get it over with. You're screwed anyway. He was happy to be wrong. The scene on the tarmac, watching Cameron, Wendy, and Bridget jumping up and down, clapping their hands, made him feel warm inside. He banged on the windows from the terminal until the people turned and looked at him. Antonio began to dance a goofy, out-of-character happy dance. Within seconds, the young kids emulated his moves, and the adults smiled and laughed. His dance over, Antonio returned to his task at hand. He turned the handle on the gate door, expecting to find it locked. It was open. "This must be my day," he said aloud. He walked down the corridor to the telescoping booth close to his plane. He was 4 feet away from the door. He could have jumped, but the cows and pigs needed to walk. He popped open the access panel on the control system, finding the same red and green wires he identified in Manchester. He hooked the wires to the battery. There were no lights or sounds letting him know he had power. Antonio grabbed the control knob, said a quick prayer, and pushed it in the direction of the plane. The compartment moved. When the ramp was against the plane, Antonio knocked on the door. He heard the lock click and levers turn on the other side. He could have opened the door himself, but it was easier to unlock from inside. The door popped open, and Peter stuck out his hand. "Great work, son. Great work." Peter looked exhausted. The adrenaline rush that carried the old man through the last hours of the flight was gone, leaving the 68-year-old haggard and tired. "You're the hero, Pete. You're the man today." Antonio displayed rare emotion, wrapping his arms around Peter in an unsolicited hug. "You earned the king-size bed tonight." Peter hugged the boy back. He hoped to stay awake long enough to find a bed, any bed, let alone a king-sized bed. "Follow me, Peter. I'll take you to one of the cars, drive you around the group. You've done enough driving for one day." Antonio kept his arm around the tall man, letting Peter shift some of his weight to him. Antonio could tell the man was almost asleep on his feet. They walked through the airport and towards the largest of their SUVs available. "Jump in the back seat and lay down. We've been napping all day. You take a break." Peter did exactly that. He was a former soldier and long-haul commercial pilot. His body was used to exerting itself up to and beyond the point of exhaustion, then collapsing for recovery. Peter climbed into the third row of the large SUV, used his hands for a pillow, and fell asleep within seconds. Antonio jumped into the driver's seat and brought the car around to the airplane. He exited the SUV quietly, pushing the door shut softly. He let everyone know that Peter was asleep in the back. The group stuck to their plan. Get off the plane, get the animals off the plane, and somewhere near the airport with food and water, find shelter, sleep. The road system on Kauai was not intricate. The adults studied and memorized the area while in Hanover. Six SUVs pulled away from the jumbo jet. Four trunks carried chickens. One trunk had goats, and the last brought food and water. Hubba sat between Emily and Todd in a front seat. Hank, Kelly, Paul, Karen, and Dan remained at the airport to tend to the cows, bull, and hogs. They waved as the SUVs pulled away, promising to be close behind. Kelly led the groggy bull off of the plane and towards baggage claim. The animals were spending the night free-range in Lihue's empty airport. It was an open area that did not have glass windows. A breeze blew through the transoms. The area was warm, but would be fine for the evening. "We're going to be back tomorrow. These animals aren't going anywhere." Kelly pointed towards benches and tables, directing the construction of makeshift pens to segregate the pigs from the cows and the bull. "Anyone want to hit the beach?" Dan wore a smile and a bathing suit, his sweat-soaked shirt clutched in his left hand. "Hell yes," Hank replied, pulling off his sweaty T-shirt. They jumped into the last SUV, rolled down the windows, and headed towards the initial meeting spot, a beach resort near the airport. The survivors banked on finding a few empty rooms in the massive hotel. Dan pointed to black smoke rising in the distance. He drove towards the smoke, and they pulled up to the resort within a few minutes. Dan drove up to the check-in circle, jumped the curb, and steered towards the beach. He used sidewalks and open areas, passed a black muck-filled pool, and stopped at the top of the sand. A bonfire blazed on the beach while everyone swam or waded in the ocean.
"It looks like they started without us."
Paul unbuttoned his Madras shirt.
"So much for our list of priorities."
Kelly opened her door and walked towards the water. The latecomers nodded to Peter, resting comfortably in a lounge chair near the fire, and waded towards a gathering of people.
"Welcome to your new home," Bernie said to Kelly, putting her arms around her in a hug. "It's been a long trip."
"So the whole idea of finding beds for the night? We'll do that when?"
Hank asked Todd, standing with Emily and watching the children splash around in the water.
"See those cabanas? We can sleep in those."
Todd pointed to a dozen beach cabanas with fabric draping down their sides. Hank was about to respond before Todd started again.
"I know, I know. We're being the grasshopper and not the ant. Look, it's been a long day. We're in Hawaii. Tomorrow is going to be another long day of hard work. Let's blow off some steam."
Hank looked at the beautiful sandy beach and the inviting Pacific Ocean. An abandoned resort sat behind them. The goats were tied to a tree and munching on tropical plants. Hank gave his brother a pat on the back before diving into the water. He popped out of the water and waded towards the goats. He wanted to see what they were eating.
"Pineapples," Hank said to himself when he got close enough to the plants. "Son of a gun! There are pineapples everywhere!"
He scanned the area and saw that the coconuts littered the ground around the palm trees, while bunches of green orbs hung high above the ground below the fronds.
"Todd!" he yelled back to the ocean. "You have a chef's knife in one of the trucks?"
"The one without chickens. It's in the box with the cookware. Why?"
Todd cupped his hands around his mouth to cut through the noise of a stiff breeze.
"Pineapples! Lots of ripe pineapples right here! Fruit!"
Hank turned to go to the cars when he realized he did not know where the cars were.
"Hey, where are the trucks?"
Todd was halfway to the beach after he heard the word fruit.
"I'll help. We didn't even think about food, just ran to the water."
He pointed towards the parking lot on the other side of the hotel.
"We obeyed pedestrian traffic laws."
They ran barefooted, using the balls of their feet and trying to not step on anything sharp. The light was fading slightly as the sun approached the horizon behind the east-facing resort. 6 SUVs were parked in a row next to the front of the resort. Wild chickens surrounded the open trunks, inspecting their caged brethren.
"This is mildly off-putting," Todd said as he shooed chickens away from his car.
"Sorry the chickens scare you."
Hank pulled a plastic box from the back of the truck and removed a large cleaver.
"Nice."
"Yeah, I picked that one up at the mall in Raleigh. Sweet, huh?"
Todd pulled a chef's knife from the box along with a flashlight. They walked back to the beach. Hank carried the entire plastic box filled with dinner supplies and cooking implements. Faint shades of orange and red filled the sky behind them. It was officially dusk.
"If we're going to find places to sleep other than the huts on the beach," Hank said to him.
"Yeah, I know."
Todd looked towards the lobby of the hotel. "I'll see if I can find a master key or something to open doors. We might have to kick doors down to get in." He held up the chef's knife, handing it to Hank to put back into the plastic bin. Todd went to find room keys.
He hoped the batteries powering the room locks still worked. Salt air and 8 months of time were not on his side.
58. During the early stages of the plague, when the disease was ravaging South America, Europe, and Asia, there were few travel restrictions for U.S. citizens within the U.S. Still, no one made trips to resort islands like Kauai. Tourists already on the island quickly departed. International travel was suspended, but European and Asian tourists fled the small island for the international airport on Oahu. Almost every plane in Hawaii was at the Honolulu airport. The handful of tourists who remained on Kauai died in the hospitals. Locals passed in their beds. The island was deserted and pristine. A stand at the front door of the lobby, printed in large red letters, read, "No vacancy." The wording of the sign was a trick devised by a hotel manager. She argued that a closed sign would invite looting and squatting, while a no-vacancy sign would fool potential squatters into believing the hotel was occupied and full. Todd, a potential squatter, fell for the trick and believed every room in the hotel contained a corpse or had dirty linen. Regardless, he scoured the front desk for a logbook or list that might indicate empty rooms. The front desk was clean of papers. There were 6 check-in stations with 6 computers. There were no logbooks or keys hanging from a pegboard, similar to the system they found at the car rental agencies at the airport. The information Todd needed was locked away on a dead server, only accessible from the dead computers in the dead hotel lobby. 3 drawers fell below each of the computer stations. Todd opened each drawer and found blank key cards, but there were no cards with room numbers or the words "master key." "Think, Todd," he muttered to himself. He looked at a door behind the front desk. He walked over and opened it. The back room did not have windows and was pitch black. He flashed his light on a small desk and saw a clipboard with papers clipped to the top. Todd walked closer and saw room numbers, dates, and check marks to indicate the last cleaning day. "Cleaning staff," he mumbled. Todd opened one of the desk drawers and found several cards on wrist lanyards. Bingo. He grabbed all of the lanyards and keys and left the back room for the beach. Todd approached the first room on the first floor next to the lobby. The key box had a yellow light on the top that was still illuminated. He slipped one of the cleaning staff's keys in the card slot on the door. It flashed green, and he heard the sound of a sliding bolt. He pushed the door open. He did not look into the room. He lifted his nose for the smell, the horrible, putrid, rotting smell he met at the Manchester airport or the houses in Raleigh and Hanover he scavenged for food. Other than a hint of mildew, the room was clean. Todd flashed his light and saw the bed was made. He flipped the deadbolt slider from the inside, assuring the door would stay open, and moved to the next door. Room after room was empty and contained clean linens. Todd unlocked the entire first floor. He walked out to the bonfire. Hubba rested in the sand next to Peter and Jamie in lounge chairs. A paper plate filled with pineapple, moose jerky, and goldfish crackers rested between them. "How did you do with the rooms?" Jamie asked. "See that building?" The resort had several buildings. Todd pointed to one behind him on the left side of the beach. "The entire first floor, 20 or so rooms, are all unlocked, unoccupied, and have clean linen. I can't speak for Bugs, but we are good to go for mattresses and sheets." "You're kidding," Jamie said back. "There aren't any bodies? How can that be?" "Jamie, I just flew on a jumbo jet from New Hampshire to Hawaii 8 months after a plague killed every living soul on the planet. I have a dog when no other dogs or cats survived. I stopped asking questions like, 'How can that be?' a long time ago." Todd held his hands out to his side and shook his head. "Would you mind if I went ahead and used one of the rooms?" Peter asked, sitting up. "I need to get some sleep." "You can do whatever you want, Peter. Here's a lanyard with a key. But I will probably sleep with my door open or unlocked."
Todd tossed him a pink wrist lanyard with a key card.
I will too.
He stood up carefully.
It's been a long day.
Peter said goodnight to Jamie. Hubba lifted his head and watched the tall old man walk towards the hotel. The sun was not down, but daylight was almost gone. There were millions of stars lighting the sky. A full moon reflected off the ocean. The bonfire made enough light for them to eat their fruit and enjoy the warm breeze coming off the water. The adrenaline loss Peter experienced swept through the group. The children were groggy, adults felt tired and sluggish, and the tribe made their way to the bedrooms. John and Solange were the only two left on the beach. He placed another piece of wood on the fire. They did not need the warmth, just the light the fire provided. Solange pushed two chaise lounge chairs together to snuggle with John.
Finally, weather I can enjoy, she said to him as he sat down next to her.
It does feel nice to not have on long pants and a flannel shirt even when inside. He put his arm under her back and she shimmied next to him. They lay together, under the Hawaiian sky, next to a fire on the tropical beach. We have a lot of work ahead of us. But not as much as I thought, John said to her. There's food hanging from the trees and growing up from the ground. If we can catch fish and find water, we can survive here. Solange had both arms around him, one under his back and the other across his chest.
It is incredible. Just the idea that we are not cold, that we can eat food without setting traps far from camp.
She looked up at him, her chin on his chest.
It is like this in Ecuador, but the snakes and bugs would swarm us off the plain, and the humidity. You would not like the humidity.
John did not reply. He held her and enjoyed the moment. There were towels hanging on the back of the chaise. John pulled them down to cover himself and Solange. He closed his eyes and drifted off to sleep. Solange continued to talk about Ecuador until she saw that he was asleep. His chest lifted and fell in a slow, easy rhythm. He had a satisfied smile on his face, a tiny grin that told her he was having nice dreams. Solange put her head back on his chest. She did not fall asleep immediately. She listened to the waves lap the shore of the cove and watched the fire dance in the night.
59. John and Solange were on the beach under half a dozen beach towels and next to a pit of smoldering black logs when the roosters began to crow. It was in the low 70s. The rising sun added degrees to the temperature every hour. Rooster after rooster crowed at the light.
"Should we catch and eat one of them?"
Solange asked, without sarcasm. Her belly rumbled.
"If you can, we'll need more than one."
They spooned on the lounge chair.
"I bet we have at least a few eggs from our own chickens. Maybe we start our breakfast with those."
"I do not want to get up," she squeezed him. "But I will light the fire." She stretched her arms out to the side. Solange went to where the bonfire had been, looking for embers she might bring to life. The fire was red in one spot. She used dry coconut husk to kickstart the flame. John walked towards the parked SUVs to check for eggs in the chicken cages. He pulled a dozen fresh eggs out of the cages, shooing away the native chickens that gathered around the cars.
"I bet a few well-placed kicks and I could have chickens for breakfast."
John believed a little hunger might motivate the younger people in the group to focus on work instead of lounging on the beach like they did last night. The roosters brought the camp to life. People staggered out of the hotel and made their way to the beach. It was early, only a few minutes after sunrise, and while they had adjourned at 9 p.m., getting up at 5:45 was still painful.
"How are we going to make coffee?"
Melanie was a bear without her coffee.
"I bet we can figure something out with the pouches in the rooms. We can use them like tea bags in a pot of water."
Paul needed his coffee, too. Necessity was breeding invention. The sporadic crowing of roosters filled the air. Paul collected the one-shot coffee pouches made for single-serving coffee pots in the hotel rooms. He looked at the 8-quart pot of water resting on the fire
and judged 8 pouches would make strong coffee. "It's a start," he told Melanie. The famous fireplace grill set Rebecca and Greg used in their first house straddled the small beach fire and easily accommodated the water pot and a giant cast-iron skillet. John cracked the eggs into the skillet and began to scramble.
"There isn't a lot, but you can supplement with all the fruit you can find."
John did not inspire the group. Weak coffee from stale hotel pouches and half an egg each was a bad start to the day. Todd could not sit idle and watch it happen.
"I love you, John, but please move aside." He pulled 2 Ziploc bags full of cooked rice out of the plastic bin. He seized the metal spatula from his brother. "Ahmed, can you tear some of this jerky into small pieces?"
Todd used the spatula to finish scrambling the eggs and set them aside on a paper plate. Todd had small jars of olive oil and soy sauce in the bin, too. He added oil to the skillet, dumped the cooked rice onto the oil, and fried the breakfast.
"Throw the mousse in as soon as it's ready. Emily?"
He looked at his wife. "Could you get some pineapple? It will add a lot of flavor."
"How about mango?"
Avery asked as she chewed a ripe fruit. She held another mango in her other hand.
"Perfect."
Todd accepted the fruit from her, tearing pieces of the mango with his finger and dropping it into the sizzling rice. When the rice and jerky were reheated, Todd dumped the eggs into the concoction, drizzled some soy sauce, and announced breakfast was ready. "That's how we stretch our eggs." Todd prepared for the first meal 2 days earlier, cooking the rice and bagging the jerky, oil, and soy sauce. Despite his desire for motivational hunger, John was pleased with the larger meal.
"It's a little spicy," Meredith said as she fanned her mouth.
She was not used to flavorful foods. Her family stuck to a bland diet. "I mixed some garlic chili paste into the soy sauce to give it a little kick." Todd was proud of himself. The fried rice was excellent.
"I thought the mango would mellow the heat enough for you."
"It's good," the girl told him. "I'm still getting used to spicy." Hank was the first to mention work.
"We need to get to the plane and unload our supplies while it's morning and not blazing hot. I bet it gets over 85 by 10 a.m. We don't have to get it all unloaded this morning, but we need to start."
"We have to find a place to live, maybe get some larger vehicles. The livestock, they need food and water. Let's focus our efforts on finding a farm, some houses, water."
Kelly wanted to move her animals to a comfortable, permanent place with food and water. The shock of their new environment, along with the trauma of flying, was a lot for an animal to take.
"Okay," Hank conceded. "I don't mind shifting our priorities, but we need to motivate. We just used our rice. Our current cooking situation is crappy. Let's get to the real estate office in town and move along with our plans. We have our entire lives to play in the water."
"Tony and I are going to catch some fish for lunch," Craig announced.
"We are?"
Antonio looked at him.
"Yeah, let's go back to the airport, get the fishing stuff, start that Mustang you were talking about, and catch some fish."
Craig was eager to try out the new waters.
"Okay, hold on," John cut in. "We have to figure out where to meet. This is not a huge island, but it's big enough that we could lose each other for a few days. Where are you going fishing, and where are you bringing all the fish you catch?" He was proud of Craig for taking initiative.
Todd jumped up. "Hold on. You keep talking. I have an idea."
He ran back to the SUVs.
"If we're going to fish off the shore, we can throw lines in right here," Antonio told John. "We just have to get the gear from the plane or try to find an outfitter here in town."
John nodded. "Okay. If you stay here, we won't have to scour the beaches for you. Don't forget to wear sunblock and hats. This sun will burn the skin right off of you."
Todd came back to the beach carrying a large plastic container and what looked like a big walnut cracker.
"Here's what I need you to do." He looked at Antonio and Craig. "I noticed a few lime trees. When you catch the fish, please fillet and chunk the meat into here, which I will have filled with lime juice and spices. It will cook the meat."
"Ceviche," Solange announced.
"Yeah, under the current conditions, it seems like the best plan," Todd replied. "So, put the fish in here. At lunch, I'll toss in avocado, mango, whatever else I can find, and we'll have a great meal. If you get really lucky with the fishing, don't put it all in here. Save some for dinner, but put enough so we can all eat."
Are you sure? We won't get sick?
Antonio asked, skeptical of the plan. It's fresh fish. We aren't going to